session number 23216 relay.
Colonel Corbould, rail 8.
I think there was something that happened in 1943 that you wanted to...
Yes, to be precise, it was the 13th of June, 1943, and we were stationed in North Africa at a place called Fort de Leau, just outside Algiers. And the late King came on a visit to the forces, and each regiment of the foot guards had to find a guard in turn. And I was lucky enough to be detailed to command the Coldstream Guard, taking over from the Grenadiers the day on the 13th of June. And this is one of the proudest days of my life, because it was very, very intimate indeed, in that the King was in this very large villa, and we had to visit all the central posts quite clearly. We in fact went through the ceremonial mounting process in the forecourt of the villa. And so then it came to the evening and so on, and I had an invitation from Sir Piers Lee, who was the equerry with the King, that the King wished you would dine with him tonight. So of course I went, and royal command. And we sat at this delightful table, and I was sat down one end of the table, and next to me at the end of the table was a man called Air Vice Marshal Fielden, who was the captain of the King's flight. And opposite me, where you are now, I think his name was Sir Alexander Harding. And on my right was a person I can't remember, but on his right up here, facing the King, was Sir Archibald Sinclair, who I think was the then Secretary of State for Air.
And former leader of the Liberal Party.
That's right. That's right, yes. And at the other end of the table, on his own, sitting facing inwards, was General Alexander, to whom, as you know, I became ADC when he was a field marshal much later on. And then the guest of honour that night was a man called Beadle Smith, who was the chief of staff to Eisenhower. And great conversation broke out during the dinner about the way that Americans spoke and how the British spoke. And the King said, I can remember distinctly, he said, turning to Beadle Smith, and he said, the only difference between your language and mine is that I talk about schedule and you talk about schedule. So this caused a bit of laugh and so on and so forth. And then the subject changed, and the King the following day was going to receive de Gaulle, who, not the most popular man of the war, as we all know. And General Alexander said to him, now, sir, tomorrow will you speak to de Gaulle in English or in French? And the King looked and said, I shall speak to him in English, and thundered the royal fist on the table. Then went on to say, because after this war, the whole world will speak English. All the wine started to spill a bit. Waiters appeared from nowhere, mopped it up and recharged the glasses. But wonderful to hear the King really giving vent to a most wonderful subject. And I've never forgotten that. So at the end of dinner, people sort of went off in their own sort of way and so on, and I was left in the drawing room on my own with the King. I mean, a singular honour, which I shall never, ever forget. And we chatted about, he asked me one or two questions about my life and what have you, and how old I was, etc., which battalion I was going to. And then, because I was getting a bit fidgety at that time, it was getting on for 11 o'clock, and if you're on guard, 11 o'clock, you've got to go on your grand rounds, as per London. So at about 5 to 11, in came Piers Lee and said, oh, he said, sir, I think that Corbyn will have to leave now, he'll have to do his rounds. And the King said, yes, so the royal hand was proffered, and I nodded my head in the appropriate way, and back towards the door, and remembering never to turn your back on the sovereign. And I got to the door, and by luck would have it, I hit the door handle just behind me, so I was able to push down, nod my head again, and disappeared backwards through the door. And the King said, well done, boy! And that was it. The following morning, of course, we dismounted guard, and he watched us dismount guard, and that was an end of a most magnificent experience which will never, ever be repeated in my life, ever again.
Was all the guard mounting done in the same way as it would have been done in London?
Yes, it was, yes. Except when we actually dismounted, we were relieved by the Scots Guards, and that took place in this forecourt. Then in order to dismiss, we had to march around the back onto a lawn at the back of the villa. And in true guardsman style, the King was standing up on the balcony watching us dismount, going through the normal drill. And it came to the stage where, of course, I realised the King was there. Of course, we had to get permission to dismiss the guard. And So I saw the guard at ease, turned about, and was just about to approach forward to the king, and he did this with his hands, which people normally do in barracks, whereupon you halt, and you salute, and you pause, you salute again, turn about, and away you go. But that was all gone through.
So that was the...
That was the
field sign for dismiss.
That was it. That was the actual King's Guard did dismiss, yes. And into our trucks and back to Fort de Leau camp.
How many guardsmen did you have on there?
It's a very good question indeed. I think I had 30. It was about a platoon's worth. A platoon guard, yes. Which was sufficient.
What uniform were they wearing?
We were in khaki drill. And sidearms, of course. No sword for me, because I didn't have anything at all. I saluted with my hand. But, yes, it was all very simple indeed, but I hope impressive and extremely memorable.
Do you remember anything else the King said besides his insistence on English being spoken?
Well, I remember one thing. He said to me across the table, he had a very loud voice, as you know, and, of course, he with an impediment and me with one. You meet a person with an impediment, you get worse. And he fired the question to me, which is you come from? And I stammered forth the infantry reinforcement training depots are, to which the King turned to General Alexander and said, I suppose some queer fangled invention of the adjutant general. That's what I remember that conversation.
Do you remember Beadle Smith saying anything?
I don't remember him saying anything at all, no. No, he was fairly quiet. But the King engaged him in conversation. There's a lot of conversation going on around the table, but these are the little bits and pieces that I actually heard.
What about Alexander? You said he was fairly taciturn.
Yes, when he was talking to whoever, I can't remember who was on his right or on his left, but he was fairly taciturn, but nevertheless, he spoke in quite a quiet way, but he was talking, yes, what he was about, I don't know at all, I'm sure. The Air Vice Marshal spoke to me a lot about flying, because I was questioning him about being the captain of the King's flight and so on. All very interesting indeed. And so really, I mean, the whole thing ended as far as I was concerned at 11 o'clock when I took leave of the King and returned to the Guard.
Who did you relieve when you arrived to take up?
The Grenadiers.
You relieved the Grenadiers and you were relieved by the Scots.
Scots Guards, yes.
So was it going in order of seniority then?
Well, at that stage it was. Who took over from the Scots Guards, I don't know. Because I don't know whether there was the Irish Guards founder guard or even indeed the... Because it probably wasn't necessary because the King had moved on, you see, to go on his tour. But certainly there were three guards. A Grenadier, Coastream, and Scots Guard. So that's that little story.
Shall we go back to Germany?
Let's go back to Germany.
You said that Splosh Jones, the divisional commander, backed you up against the brigade commander. The CO, not the brigade commander.
Well, and the
brigade commander. Who had
it was the commanding officer and the brigadier against me.
got things wrong. What happened? Were there any repercussions as a result of that clash of views?
Well, yes, there were, actually. Whether this was a direct result of this confrontation I had with this man, I don't know. But the commanding officer got relieved and another chap came in. It was time.
Is it Corbould the Kingmaker, do you think?
I think not. In no way at all.
Coincidence, do you think?
I think also he'd made other bogs as well. He was not the most brilliant of commanding officers and has not been disloyal. That's all I'm prepared to say.
Was he the man who'd been a prisoner of war?
No, he was a brigadier.
He'd been taken
prisoner at Dunkirk, you see, and did 5 years, poor man.
So he would have been out of touch. But
he was, yes. I suppose in life and after all, I was in the army for 37 years, you're bound to find someone who dislikes you intensely. And those two disliked me intensely. And it was reciprocated, I can assure you.
I mean, was this a personal feeling as well as a professional one, do you think?
I think it was more personal, I think.
Clash of personality.
I think so, yes. Yeah. Yes. That's what it really was, I think, yes. But, I mean, that did even at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the brigadier said to me, you're meant to have all your chaps tied together and so on. I said, I didn't know, sir, but I can tell you from personal experience, it doesn't work in war. That did it.
Did things improve when the new CO arrived?
I went very shortly after that back to serve in the Elbow Forces depot as the adjutant.
Right.
But there was an enormous improvement in the battalion, yes.
Where was the Airborne Forces depot? Was that at Aldershot?
Aldershot, yes. In Maida Barracks, Aldershot. And they were wanting an an adjutant there, and I got blown for.
Now, you'd been adjutant before, hadn't you?
In India. At the officers' training school in Bangalore, yes.
Would you compare the two appointments?
Well, you couldn't possibly. There's nothing like it. I mean, it's just.
Nothing like.
They were different as chalk from cheese, yes. You're dealing with an entirely different type of men for a start. There was no. They were all British people. And, of course, all the officers were seconded from other regiments as well. That time, they were all seconded. And so. And we couldn't. And then in 1955, I think it was, we were able to recruit our own soldiers straight into the parish regiment. And I then got switched from being the adjutant to command the first recruit company. And I'm proud to say that at that time, that recruit company of the parish regiment was the only all regular company in the army.
What were the duties of adjutant at Aldershot then compared to those at Bangalore? What?
Well, the commanding officer was a full colonel, and he was what I would term as the regimental lieutenant colonel of the parish regiment. A delightful man called Colonel Pine Coffin, heavily decorated in the war, two DSOs and an MC.
Had he been formerly Duke of Cornwall?
No, he was in the Devonshire regiment.
Devonshire.
Yes. He had a nephew called John, who was also serving with one para at that time. But he commanded seven para. Why you got mixed up with the light infantry was he commanded the light infantry battalion, although he in fact was a Devonshire regiment chap. Yep.
So he was the commanding officer. And what was the adjutant's work? Was it mainly discipline, or was it organisation, or was it acting as right hand man to the?
Well, there was a second in command as well.
There was.
And the three of us all got on together terribly well. A man called Jimmy Gurley, the Royal Scots, and we all worked as a threesome team. Yes, administration, discipline, recruiting, setting up this new company.
How did the discipline compare?
With?
Bangalore.
Oh, well, discipline to me is discipline. I mean, I find it very hard to answer that question, Nigel, because, I mean, you're told to do things, you can get on with it.
But I mean, sometimes soldiers don't. And did you have more cases in Aldershot than you did in Bangalore?
No. I had no trouble in Aldershot at all. Mm. Absolutely none. The guardroom was straight opposite my office.
And the guardroom was empty.
It was, yes. People were told. I mean, when I got to command this recruit company, I did the same as they do at the guards' depot. I ran it just like the same as the guards' depot occasion was in those days. And I confined them all to barracks for the first 4 weeks. They weren't allowed out at all. But we worked them jolly hard. So they didn't get bored. They got very tired. And then we had a little tiny passing out sort of parade at the end of the fourth week. And, of course, by this time, they were as keen as mustard.
This is rather like the cadets passing off parade here, isn't it?
Passing off the square. Yes.
What was the recruiting like?
Well, they all came pouring in. Mm. I used to see these recruits. They'd arrive every afternoon at 4 o'clock. We had no shortage of recruits coming in at all. And some of the personalities changed a great deal. I mean, we had one chap came in one day, and he was an absolute brute. He came in chewing gum, you know. And when they looked at his shoes, he got sort of razor blades in his toe caps and all that sort of thing. He was a really unpleasant chap. And so the platoon sergeant, who was the platoon, his particular platoon, said, I have to be careful with that chap. So I said, yes, you want to be very careful indeed and keep me informed every day. Well, this chap became thoroughly unpleasant. And in the end, he drove the sergeant, who was a marvellous man, who in fact won a George Medal later on. He took him round the back and thumped him. And he said, you know, any more of this, you've got to get some more of this. And so in a night, that man changed, absolutely changed. And he became the champion recruit. And at the passing out parade of every platoon, we had some distinguished people came round to take the passing out parades. I mean, very senior officers of all three services. Because we were rather, you know, an unusual crowd of people. We were all regulars, all professional soldiers. And the parents all used to turn up. So, the parents of this chap turned up, and they couldn't believe their eyes. They got him into the army because he was so hopeless outside. And this father came up to me and said, oh, he said, I don't know what you've done to my son. I said, he's a changed man. I said, he's actually a first-class chap. But I said, no thanks to you. And I said, I'll tell you something. And I told him the story. And I said, you should have given him a thumping before he came into the army. He said, I know I should, but his mother wouldn't let me. But I said, well, there you are. But I said, this is what happened. And look what he's done for your boy. Mm. And he ended up, I think, he certainly ended up to become commissar, if not a commissar major.
What did you have to do in order to become the champion recruit?
Well, you had to be a good, like, sort of on a champion. I know this game, the ridiculous is sublime. But, I mean, you're just the best all-rounder. Mm. Sportsman, intelligence, drill, shooting. And you were just known as, you became the best recruit.
What did you actually have to do in order to set up recruit company then? What processes did you have to?
Well, I took it initially when the recruits arrived, they were blistered onto what we call P Company, and you've heard of P Company.
Yes.
Well, because that didn't really work at all, because the P Company were putting through chaps with their pre parachute training who'd already trained soldiers.
Yeah.
So it was a ridiculous amalgamation. Mm. That's why they cut them in half and.
Two separate functions.
Two separate years. Mm. And so, I've got the question. I'd ask you how you go about setting up a company, as it were. Well, I mean, I was given three officers, a commissar major, company commissar, a full company staff. Mm. And then the question was setting the example and having them run, electing them, saying, I propose to do X, Y, and Z. Mm. And this is how we're going to run this thing.
Did you set the syllabus of training?
Yes.
What did you put into
all the basics. Taught them to march, taught them to shoot, put them into the ring, milling contests, immense amount of physical training, and also some mental work as well. We'd give them some little, I got the exam, the education corps chap, to set them some exam papers and so on, see what their intelligence was actually like.
Would this be the Army Certificate of Education?
That sort of thing, going up to the towards the third class, yes.
Basic school subjects?
Yes. Mm. History, maths, reading, writing, this sort of thing. And it's extraordinary how some of these chaps, they were really quite well educated. I mean, they had brains. And they thought they'd produce some quite good little essays and so on. So it was a conglomeration of everything, basically, you can think of. So by the time they got to battalion, they could think properly, they were thoroughly fit, they were excellent shots.
How long did the training take for each recruit going into?
We put them through training for 16 weeks, yes.
That's quite a long time, isn't
quite
it?
Quite a long
longer
time,
than
yes.
Training had
yes.
been.
But then, of course, we incorporated a little bit of P-Company stuff as well.
Yes.
The log race and all that sort of torture.
Did they go on from recruit company to P-Company?
No. They did sufficient work. And if I would also consult with the officer commanding P-Company, who come and watch some of our activities,
yes.
And they go straight to the parachute school.
Ah.
That saved time. So otherwise, there'd be another fortnight in P Company before going onto the parachute school.
So you were progressing from basic training to P Company training, and then they went to
the school
to jump
at Abingdon.
How many of them did you have? How many could you handle going through P Company at a time? Going through recruit company.
Recruit company at the time. I think I had on the go all the time three platoons.
Yes.
And then, of course, there was one, the fourth platoon, there was the form-up platoon. They all just arrived straight from civilian life. Mm-hmm. And I worked my platoon commanders extremely hard, too.
So would you be working then with about 90 men at a time?
That sort of thing.
Yes. Did you have any choice of officers, or were you just given junior officers?
I, knowing the commanding officer, and I saw the chaps coming through P Company, and I'd go to the commanding officer, I want X. I got X. I was in a rather privileged position, actually.
It sounds like you had a very good location.
Well, I did, you see. And also, because I had the pick of the, not always, but the majority of my NCOs were the pick of the battalion, which was very unpopular, you see, with the commanding officers of the battalions. But as I said to the commanding officer, I used to address the commanding officers regularly. I said, you know, if you want good recruits, you've got to give me good NCOs.
Mm. How were the recruits for our company selected? Did you have any part in doing that?
No, they came straight off the street, mm-hmm. And we selected them. We had a personal selection officer who I used to guide.
Mm. What qualities did you tell him to look for then when you were?
Well, to see what their mentality was like, what was going on in their mind. Mm. Could they absorb things? Could they take discipline? Could they enunciate? That sort of thing. It was very basic stuff. But I used to sometimes have a difference of opinion with this personnel selection officer. But anyway, I always got my way, because that was what my job was. But no, it was quite hard work, actually, very hard work. One used to work 7 days a week. And I'd go around sometimes in the evenings, go around the barrack rooms with a platoon commander.
Well, if you're keeping them busy, it keeps you busy keeping them busy.
Oh, yes, exactly. And one's going to lead by example, too. Mm. And my wife was often, she was my late wife. She died in 1979, but during that time, we were sort of a youngish married couple, and she was very good on the pastoral priest, speaking to all the parents and chatting them up and preaching the gospel of the family spirit and so on. She was excellent at that.
Did wives generally play a greater part in the life of a regiment in those days?
I think they probably did. Well, they still do to a great extent today. Of course they do. Of course they do. But I think they rather accepted army life easier in those days than they probably do today. Mind you, of course, the army today, of course, is so overstretched. It's ridiculous. And I feel very sorry for the families. Then, of course, leads one on to the next point of retention. In those days, we didn't have much problem in retaining people.
I was going to say, how long did your recruits sign on for? They came in as regulars.
They came in as regulars. They signed on initially for three years.
3 years. Did any of them sign on for longer?
Yes, they did.
First go.
Yes, and stayed on for nine years. Yes, yes. And I was always preaching that gospel to them because we wanted to, having trained them, spent all that time, we didn't want to lose them after 3 years.
Presumably you had a failure rate with our company. You did find people who were not suitable
We
didn't
did
live up to expectations.
Oh, yes, yes.
What sort of numbers are we talking about in terms of back-terming or...
you had back-squad chaps who were who obviously headed in them but wanted a bit more training. I would think that out of a platoon of, say, 30, I would think that I'd get straight through without any back-squadding at all, on average 20. And you had about 10 people I had to think about. You know.
And out of that 10, how many would be backsworn and how many would you conclude?
Out of that 10, we would put 7 in a backsworn and get rid of about 3.
Mm. That's about 10% dropout.
That sort of thing,
right.
Yes. I mean, we had a case one morning and one of the platoon sergeants came back to me and said, we had a terrible scene in the barrack room, sir. So there's a chap who's a queer. Oh. He was out through the barrack gate by midday. That wouldn't happen now.
Well, no, it wouldn't, unfortunately.
Yes, I'm ahead of his own good. I think they'd have slaughtered him.
What happened to those who were deemed unfit for the parachute regiment?
They would offer them to transfer. And this is where the personnel selection officer would come in and then talk them to some other arm of the service.
Yes.
And that was successful. Mm. So our total loss, was not all that great.
Do you have any idea of what number of these recruits came from what you might call military families? In other words, families who habitually provided soldiers for
some the army. Some did. Mm. Not many.
Not many.
But the majority of the fathers, of course, had done national service or served in the war. But not many of them were actually sons of regular soldiers. We had an extraordinary thing one day. We had the son of an air commodore. And he turned out to be a most dreadful man. And he, held up a bank. And that was all very embarrassing indeed.
Was this before or after he joined?
After
he joined. Was he in service when he held up the bank?
Well, he was going through the preliminary entry procedure.
Mm.
But we got rid of him, obviously, very sharply indeed, as a civilian. But I felt very sorry for the father. Mm. A terrible thing to have happened. Mm.
What sort of reasons did they give for wanting to join the parachute regiment?
Oh, they thought it was going to be marvellous to be a paratrooper, as they called it. Mm. And it was all rather glamorous, they thought, and so on and so forth. But I mean, I had to go on into all that and say, look, it's a jolly hard lot, this. Mm. But never mind, by doing all these various exercises and so on, and working them really hard, and making them do a most enormous amount of physical work in the gym, they would accept it. Mm.
Did you get to know them all personally, or did you have to leave that to the platoon commanders?
I got to know them all personally. I made it my business to do so. And I questioned my platoon commanders about them, too.
Did they all have an interview with you then when they arrived?
Oh, yes. Oh. Well, I'd interview them all, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That intake would be interviewed by me that day, en masse. It may be 10, 12 chaps. It would come in into my company headquarters, and I would address them all, shake them all by the hand, welcome them, and try to make them feel as home as possible.
And how often would they come in? Would it be every week or every month or every?
It was three times a week.
Three times a week.
Yeah, three times a week. Yes, and they came from some place, some recruiting offices and so on and so forth. When they'd been told to go home, then go back to the recruiting office, then they'd be told when to report to Maynard Barracks in Aldershot.
They come into your forming up platoon.
How
long
yeah.
would they be in that before they went on to the?
Well, they probably remained in that platoon, probably.
Yes.
Because another platoon had passed out, so then we'd start again.
So you would you have a platoon passing out every month or something like that?
Every fortnight.
Every fortnight.
Yes, every Saturday morning. Mm. It's a big old do.
It's quite a sausage machine, isn't it?
It was a total sausage machine, yes. Mm. Now, the next thing, Nigel, was this. It comes to 1956, and the Suez Crisis came up.
Yes.
All the reservists started coming back.
Gosh.
So what happened there?
What did happen?
Corbould was told, right, you're going to command only the recruit company, you're going to command all the reservists as well.
That's a double company.
So it was more than that. I had at one stage a battalion's worth under my command in a different barracks.
Where were they put?
We were in Maynard Barracks, in Maynard Barracks, and they were in Corona Barracks next door.
What was Maynard Barracks like at that time? Was it still the Victorian
barracks? Yes, they were all the old Victorian barracks then.
And Corona as well?
And Corona, yes. Albuera, Barossa, they were all there, yes. All there.
What did the reservists make of it when they were called back?
Well, some of them weren't very pleased, of course, but they made the best of it. And the old airborne spirit came back, with the camaraderie, the esprit de corps, and they all got on. We had no problem with the reservists at all. Mind you, we didn't keep them all that long, because they wanted with the three battalions.
What actually happened to them then? They'd come in.
They had to be re-kitted out and so on, get them onto the range as quick as possible, get them fit. That was the main thing.
How long did that take to get them back into fitness?
They were fairly young chaps, you see. Mm. I mean, it wouldn't have been more than 3 weeks, I wouldn't think. They were reasonable. They would continue, of course, in the battalions, too.
What about their shooting skills, which were also...
Oh, then, I hadn't gone off. The shooting skills were quite good. Mm. Yes.
And were these fellows, were any of them World War II veterans, or were they mostly younger?
1956. Well, you see, the war had been over for, 11 years. Mm. No, I don't think they were veterans. They went to Arnhemites.
They jumped across the Rhine.
No. Some of the instructors, of course, had done that. Mm. I mean, we had plenty of the instructors had World War II ribbons on, and they'd done that, yes, but not actually the chaps. I can't remember any of those reservists coming back with Second World War ribbons.
Had any of them seen active service?
Yeah, in Palestine, 1946, 47, 48 time. Yes. Yes.
Were any of them really pleased to be back?
I can't say that, no. But they accepted it. Is all I can say, not really about that. They accepted it with a good heart. Mm. They knew it was a job they had to do. Mm. Get on with it.
So, was your work with them mainly one of administration?
Mainly.
Documentation?
I didn't do that, but I was supervised all the years. But I made it my business to go around and talk to them all. Either en masse or individually. A hell of a lot. And that, to me, is a very important thing to have to do indeed. And, it makes sure that their families were under control, with their financial situations were, etc. But a lot of them, of course, had come from jobs, and they were getting back to those jobs as well.
Were there any who were seriously concerned they might not have a job open?
I don't remember that, no. Never had any questions asked me on that sort of thing at all. Or I was never asked to write to a firm, say, will you take Bloggins back? That sort of thing. Mm. I was never asked to do that. I would have done if I'd been asked, of course.
What about family trouble? Were there any who were really seriously concerned about family circumstances? Was there anything you could do about...
Well, the only thing was because they were concerned about the finances of their wives, because a lot of them, of course, were married. Mm. And so therefore, I used to get hold of the pay corps people to come around and talk to them on that. And any problems, I'd hand it over to the pay corps to deal with. Who'd then get in touch with the equivalent of what the social security people, I suppose. Mm.